Elizabeth Wetmore's novel Valentine celebrates the resourcefulness and solidarity of women.
I spend a lot of time thinking about how women and girls who maybe don't have a lot of resources or a lot of maybe education or money or options still manage to find a way to support each other and hold each other up.
We talk with Wetmore about her stunning debut novel, Valentine. Then we play excerpts from my 2017 interview with Carol Anderson about her award-winning book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm host and producer Francesca Rhiannon. I'm going to say this right up front. You must read Elizabeth Wetmore's wonderful novel, Valentine. The writing is a sheer pleasure to read, but the book goes way beyond just good writing. Wetmore's characters really stayed with me. I wanted to know what happened to them after the end of the story. That will have to wait. Valentine begins hard, with the brutal rape of a 14-year-old Mexican-American girl in a hardscrabble town in Texas's oil patch in 1976. But you quickly realize this isn't a story about victimhood. It's about resilience and the solidarity of women, even in the face of a racist and sexist culture. Valentine is one of the best debut novels I've read. Anne Patchett called it a novel of moral urgency and breathtaking prose, saying this is the very definition of a stunning debut. Elizabeth Wetmore is older than many authors publishing their first novel. She's 52, and Valentine took her more than a decade to write. But I think that ended up being a plus, as I told her before we formally began the interview. I think the age is an advantage, and the fact that you did spend 14 years on this. I mean, you know, if you're in your 20s, no matter how wonderful a writer you may be, you just lack the kind of life experience that can really enrich characters in the way that you did in this absolutely stunning novel, Valentine.
Well, for me, it is really true that, you know, while there are definitely writers who are unusually wise and sympathetic and insightful and able to pen a great book, you know, in their 20s that sort of speaks to some of the things that concern us all always. I actually was not that writer. I really, really had to live a fair amount of life before I was ready to sit down and write this book.
And we're so glad you did. And I'm going to welcome you now, Elizabeth Wetmore, to Writer's Voice.
Thank you for having me.
One of the characters in your book says, "Stories can save your life." And when I read that, it seemed to be the very heart of this book in a way. Is that your own personal creed?
It really is. I first sort of sensed this as a little girl growing up in West Texas, a little girl with a deep, deep love of reading, not always perhaps the most focused reading, but I read voraciously and was one of those kids that if none of the adults in the house had time to run me down to the main branch of the library, I would finish a stack of books and just start over again. You know, I read almost compulsively and I read for all kinds of reasons, not the least of which was that books were really my first way of seeing how different the world was in other places, and that not every life was the same as mine. You know, of course, I grew up in the 70s, so this is all well pre-internet, you know. And so for me, books were really a lifesaver. And of course, I read for all the other usual reasons, to be entertained and because the words were beautiful and to escape. And to this day, I often have told people that one of the greatest days of my life was the day the bookmobile came to town and parked on a lot that wasn't very far from my parents' house. So I was able to ride my bike up and get as many books as I wanted, as often as I wanted. And for me, that was just a miraculous thing.
And the bookmobile appears quite a few times in this book as well.
Yeah, it's the bookmobile and college radio both have are institutions of my hometown that I look back on with great affection, and were both really important to me. And of course, my experiences with the bookmobile were experiences I lifted for one of my young characters in the book, who also spends a lot of time there. So I can still remember the smell of that shag carpet and the sound of the swamp cooler rumbling to this day.
Oh, that's wonderful. So now let's get to this novel, Valentine. The book begins with the brutal rape of a 14-year-old girl on Valentine's Day, who begins the chapter with the name Gloria, but ends it with the name Glory. And right there, one has a very full sense of the incredible grit and power of this young girl who has just experienced one of the most horrible things any girl or woman can experience. Tell us about Glory.
Well, to me, she is the true hero of this book. She is a character who saves her own life in the opening pages and suffers this just unimaginable trauma, and who literally rises up and walks away and saves her own life, you know. And the whole book, her sections in the book are really a chronicle of her loss of her mother in very short order after the attack, her struggle to heal, her ability to survive, honestly. In every important way, to me, she was the biggest hero of this book. And I think all of these women and girls in the book are heroic in their own ways. I spend a lot of time thinking about how women and girls who maybe don't have a lot of resources or a lot of maybe education or money or options still manage to find a way to support each other and hold each other up and to survive. And so she is really, to me, the heart of the book in so many ways.
She goes to the door of a young mother, Mary Rose, who's another character you follow in the book. And I read somewhere that Valentine grew out of two questions. We'll just take the first one. What do you do when a stranger comes to your door? Which is what happens here. And Mary Rose is confronted with that question. Tell us about that.
For me, it's maybe one of the most important questions a person asks and answers in their own lives. You know, when the stranger, you know, comes to your door seeking help. Whether that stranger is an injured young girl standing on your front porch, or the stranger is a family of migrant workers who have come to your country, you know, seeking help. What is the choice you make as an individual, as a community? Do you open that door and welcome them in? And that's a question that, in a lot of ways, I think is at the heart of what it means to be human. And a question I think we all confront every day of our lives in large ways and small ways. You know, one of the things that really interested me in this book, and particularly with Glory, was how the smallest moments of kindness make all the difference in the world. The way her uncle looks after her, a very brief encounter in a swimming pool midway through the novel, when a stranger reaches out to her and just takes her hand, you know, and how that moment is quiet. These women will never meet again, but it also is kind of a turning point in her own sort of healing. And so I think a lot about people who don't necessarily think of themselves as heroes or heroic, and who don't see their lives in that way, and yet in very small daily ways, you know, they have a huge impact on other people.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Elizabeth Wetmore about her stunning new novel, Valentine. And so many of these women are, in fact, you know, confronted with that choice, not just Mary Rose, whether to respond as a human being or to respond as somebody who's been formed by their society. This novel takes place in West Texas, in Odessa, in 1976, in the oil patch during the oil boom. Tell us about the setting and what drew you to this time and place.
Well, the setting was very familiar to me. I grew up in West Texas in the 1970s. I was about the same age as one of my young narrators, Deborah Ann Pierce. And so for the street, Larkspur Lane, where much of the book is set, I drew directly on my own street, the place where I grew up. And so I tend to be pretty rooted in physical details and place. And so that initial choice was important to me because I knew I could mine a lot of my memories. And of course, you know, at 52 as a debut novel, when I was looking back on this place, I was looking back, you know, many, many years. And so I chose the place because it was familiar to me, but also it's such a singular landscape. And of course, a one economy town is very interesting to me. And an oil town is very interesting to me. An oil town is a place where the population swells and contracts pretty dramatically based on the price of oil. It's a place where the entire economy is dependent on extraction and the environmental hazards that accompany that. So I began there. I chose 1976 because I did want to set the book in the midst of an oil boom because of some of the societal ills that accompany an oil boom. For people who don't know a lot about it, Odessa is a small city in the southern end of the Llano Estacado. And here in Chicago, where I've lived for 18 years, when I talk about the oil industry with my friends, people who don't know West Texas, they often have an image of the oil industry as these enormous oil corporations and oil executives and environmental devastation. And of course, that's true. But the place where I grew up was filled with working class people, the men and women who worked in the oil patch, the men as pipe haulers and drillers, and the women in support industries like bartending and waitressing. And so these were folks, and to this day, this is true, who, you know, in the best of economic times, were really hanging on to sort of the lower end of the middle class. And of course, when the oil bust comes, and it always does, inevitably, they suffer immediately. And so I was interested in the sort of the increased traffic and the increased crime and sort of the pressures these women were put under during an oil boom. And of course, it's such a mixed bag because on the one hand, people can pay their bills, right? and maybe sock away a little for college for their kids. And on the other hand, and I have some of my characters talk about, you know, not even, I think I have at one point a character muses that, you know, she can't even go fill up her goddamn gas tank, right, without being harassed on the streets. And that's accurate to my experiences there growing up and to, you know, I think, you know, what I've read about other towns is other oil towns as well.
This very richly detailed working class life, but more than, I mean, the men do play a role in the book, but they're not the ones whose voices, they're not the lens through which we see the world. The lens through which we see the world is that of women, you know, who experience not only the harassment, but the persistent threat of violence. I mean, the violence against women goes up. And of course, this whole novel, Ballantine, revolves around a singular act of violence against Gloria, the young girl, but also the racism, which it really does play a huge part in this story because Gloria, or Glory, is Mexican-American. She's born in the United States, but she's Mexican-American. Her mother is an undocumented immigrant, and the way she is looked upon by most of the people in the town is, you know, pretty distressing. Yet the women that you follow, most of the women that you follow, the characters that you follow in this book, take her side, and they experience a lot of pushback because of it. I wonder if you could talk about that.
Sure. Well, you know, racism, the issue of racism really took on a life of its own, draft by draft. And as I began the book, I understood that I could not write a book set in this time and this place without at least attempting to reckon with the racism, casual and otherwise, that I had seen growing up there. And of course, you know, as a young white girl growing up on the north side of a deeply segregated town, the lens through which I saw it was so incredibly limited. And yet it was a daily part of my life growing up. And so I knew I couldn't write this book without at least attempting to reckon with. And of course, because I had been gone for so long, one of the first things I did, you know, when I would go back to visit family, I still have family in the area, was to go downtown and start looking through old records, old newspapers at the library, and trying to learn a little bit more about the lives of people who lived in the town where I grew up, who I didn't know. And that really underscored for me the importance of making racism front and center in the book. And it's a poison that, you know, was really stitched into the very fabric of that community, and really something that the entire state of Texas has to reckon with. And thankfully, in the last, you know, 20 years or so, I think that's happening more and more. You're seeing a lot more diverse voices speaking from Texas, writers and artists and musicians, and a real attempt on the part of scholars to reckon a bit more honestly with the really complicated history of that state. And don't get me wrong, I love my hometown and I love my state, and it's filled with people who are working hard and trying to do the right thing. But that ill, you know, that poison is part and parcel of the town and the state. And so I wanted to reckon as honestly as I was able with that. And the women in the town, you know, they do take her part, but even those characters have some limitations. Mary Rose Whitehead, you know, for example, is never really able to talk about what has happened to Glory in terms other than, you know, comparing her to her own daughter. What if this had happened to my daughter, right? Which is, of course, a legitimate and real fear. But even Mary Rose is somewhat limited in her ability to see Glory and her family fully and richly. And that was somewhat by design. You know, it was important to me not to let the white women in this town save her. You know, so Mary Rose's efforts, while heroic to testify at this trial, I mean, they don't really result in any real justice for Glory and her family. What justice they get comes by way of accident, and what healing she gets comes by way of the support and love of her uncle. And so it was important to me to some degree treat Glory a bit separately, to hold her a bit apart from this larger community of women, in part because that felt realistic to me to the time and place. So for example, after that moment on Mary Rose's front porch, Glory and Mary Rose are never in a scene together again. You know, Glory never visits Larkspur Lane and has a conversation with the other women and girls in the book. And that was important to me because it felt real and true to the time and the place and the characters I was trying to build.
And what wonderful characters. I'd like to talk a little bit about some of them. There's Corinne. You know, what struck me is that many of the men in the book are kind of hopeless. Well, not entirely. Everybody is a person. Nobody is a cartoon character, but a number of the men stand out. And Corinne's husband, Potter, is one of them. Talk about the relationship, the long years of relationship that unfurl in her memory in this book, and how you portrayed that. It's really kind of a remarkable story in itself, how you get inside this very complex character of Corinne.
Yeah, you know, she is one of, I mean, I love all of these characters deeply, actually. And every single one of these characters in this book is an amalgamation of the many, many voices I heard as a child growing up in Odessa. In addition to being an avid reader, I was quite a little eavesdropper. Harriet the Spy for a time was one of my favorite books. And I spent a lot of time as a little girl eavesdropping on my mom and her girlfriends and the neighbors and other little girls on the street and listening to them tell stories on the back porch after supper with their mixed drinks and their cigarette. And so every one of these characters I have a really deep affection and respect for. It took me a while to understand them in ways that were nuanced enough to be able to tell these stories and to really honor their stories. I think I mentioned that it took me a long time to write this book, and part of that was that it took me a long time to see my hometown and the women and girls that I had grown up with in ways that were complicated enough to honor them, I guess. So Corrine is one of my favorite characters, and she was a surprise to me. She was the biggest surprise in the book to me. I had imagined her, and in fact, it was not until very late, maybe four or five drafts in the book, that she really became a major character. I had imagined her as a very minor character who occasionally sort of walked across the street to dispense advice or drop a pithy one-liner or deliver some news that would forward my plot. And I had not imagined her as a major character until very late in the book. And what happened was that I initially had a chapter from Potter's point of view. And when I made the decision that I was going to pluck out several male points of view, I had several chapters that were from the point of view of men in the book. Part of that was because I was up against the difficulty of writing about that economy without writing from the points of view of men, because it is such a male-dominated industry even today. You know, you don't see a lot of women working as roughnecks even now. And it was important to me to talk about that economy and the sort of environmental devastation. And I wasn't sure how to do that without having male points of view. But when I made the decision that I really wanted this book to be the stories of the women and girls and started plucking those male points of view out, when I came to Potter, I loved his chapters. And it occurred to me that I had not really given a whole lot of thought to this woman who shared his life in those chapters. And so once I began asking myself some questions about Corrine, how her grief for this man that she loved would manifest and what her story was and what her rage, you know, as she's an English teacher, she was a high school English teacher. So she has a lifetime, you know, of staring out, you know, across these classrooms filled with these young women who are living in a pretty tough town, a pretty tough town to be a girl in, you know. And so once I started really kind of contemplating who she was and asking myself some questions about her, she just rose right up off the page. I think too, probably, you know, I've mentioned that I worked on the book for 14 years. And one of the things that happens when you work on a book on and off for that long is that the world changes and you change. And I think that it took me a long time to have my own life experiences that would allow me to sort of really understand her sorrow and her rage in ways that were meaningful enough to create this just marvelous character. I mean, I think, you know, next to Glory, she's probably my favorite character in the book and one with whom I feel a great kinship.
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Elizabeth Wetmore about her stunning new novel, Valentine. You really move back and forth in time quite a bit in this book, and I think you do it extraordinarily skillfully. All the writing, this is just some of the best writing I have read in, you know, and I read a lot of wonderful books, and this one really rises to the top. So I wonder if you could talk to me, you know, 14 years, it is a long time. Talk about your own process of writing and maturation as a writer through that time.
Well, and I should be clear and honest. When I say 14 years, you know, I didn't get up every day for 14 years and work on the book. I had years where I hardly worked on it at all. When my son was born, I hardly wrote anything at all. I was always sort of trying to squeeze the book in around raising my son and working and earning a living. My husband and I, you know, have always sort of kind of hung on to the sort of lower end of the middle class. And like a lot of liberal arts majors, we've made our living often doing several jobs, you know, sort of cobbling together a living. I joke that my husband and I were doing the gig economy before anyone called it the gig economy. So I took long breaks from the book. And I also took long breaks from the book because I occasionally lost my nerve. It was incredibly important to me to do it right. I wanted so badly to get this place and this time and these women and girls right and write a love letter to them and to my hometown and to the state of Texas and to that beautiful land. Odessa is not thought of as a particularly pretty place. And in a lot of ways, I think that's been to its detriment because I think a lot of people who don't live there don't see that land as something worth saving. And so when decisions are being made about things like fracking and horizontal drilling and storing wastewater, you know, people don't necessarily see that as a place that's worth considering. And so it was incredibly important to me to get it right. And I sometimes lost my nerve and just had to walk away from it. I wrote a lot of short stories while I was also working on this book, which is the form I'm really most comfortable with. And I think you see that, you know, that residue in the book, that many of those chapters read as if they're short stories. But in terms of the writing, you know, I make all of my decisions pretty intuitively, and I read aloud constantly. You will never find me working in the corner of a coffee shop because I stop frequently and just read aloud, and I work very, very slowly. The other reason it took me 14 years, because I'm incredibly slow. So I can work on an entire paragraph for a whole morning and then start all over and just throw it out completely. I spend a lot of time experimenting with point of view and tense and moving back and forth in time. And I make those decisions almost entirely based on the sound of the language and the words and the musicality of them. So my method is pretty haphazard at best.
Well, it really shows because I had to read this book slowly because the language is so rich. And you know, there were sentences that I read over and over again just to enjoy them again. And you know, so often, you know, somebody may write very beautifully, but the characters, you know, may be thin, or the characters really deep, but the language is more pedestrian. You really bring the two together, and the love for these characters is so evident.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it took me a long time. I have a pretty complicated relationship with my hometown. I left at 18 with no particular plan. I had been a really, really mediocre student. So I wasn't leaving home to go off to college. You know, there's this kind of common story, you know, the local girl who's, you know, grows up in this rough and tumble hometown, but she's a great student and she gets a fabulous scholarship and she's off to the races. That was not my story. I left young and with just a couple of $100 in my pocket and no particular plan. And I spent a lot of time, a lot of years waiting tables. I eventually started to take a few classes at a community college, you know, just here and there as I was able to afford them. And then eventually transferred to a four-year university and continued taking classes as I was able to afford them. So I was always like kind of squeezing things around, you know, working. And so, you know, when I started to write fiction in my mid to late 20s, for the first few years, I did not write a single thing set in Texas, and I didn't think I ever would. And I think part of that was because for my lack of formal education and coming from a family where being a writer is something, or an artist of any sort, is something that's prized and sort of sought after and supported. You know, my dad worked for 30 years in the petrochemical plant in my hometown. You know, I'm the first of my family to get a degree from a university, you know. So when you come from a place like that, you know, I think I came to writing without a lot of formal education, but I think I understood early that you had to come to all of your work from a place of love. And frankly, it took me a long time to be able to muster that, to access that. And one of the ways I did it was by living. I couldn't have written this book before I became a mom, for example. Having my son really changed the way I saw all the women in this book for the better. I suddenly had so much more compassion for the difficulties they faced. I mean, Mary Rose Whitehead is 26 years old and she has a 9-year-old daughter. You know, she is so young, you know, which was also very common in my hometown. My parents were very young parents. And so it took me a while to do that. So one way I accessed it was by my own life experiences, becoming a mom, working, getting older, having my own sorrows, you know, my own struggles. But the other way I accessed it was by making it a point when I'd go home to visit family to take really, really long drives through the oil patch. And so falling in love with that land was really one of the first ways I was able to start falling back in love with my hometown and the people who live there.
Well, Elizabeth Wetmore, it has been such a privilege to talk with you about this stunning and wonderful book, Valentine. I look forward to another book from you. Hopefully it won't take another 14 years.
I hope not. I mean, the good news is that I threw out hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of pages after about 3 drafts and plucked out about 25 pages, and that those 25 pages became Valentine. So I have tons and tons and tons of other material from later years in Odessa, 1981, 82, 1986, 87, and I'm working on those now. So, but yeah, I certainly hope it does not take 14 years. So, and thank you for having me. Thank you for reading. I really appreciate it. So I know that these are hard days, and I'm incredibly grateful to people who have gone out and bought the book when I know money is tight for a lot of people, and who have taken the time to read Valentine and spend some time talking with me about it. So thank you.
Elizabeth Wetmore. You can read one of her stories by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, we revisit my 2017 interview with African American Studies scholar Carol Anderson about her award-winning book, White Rage. It's on many lists of books about systemic racism in the U.S. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. In 2017, I interviewed African American Studies scholar Carol Anderson about her groundbreaking book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Anderson says every time African Americans make gains, from ending slavery to voting rights to the election of a black president, white Americans mobilize relentlessly to roll back those gains. She says the correct question is not why black people are angry, it's why whites are so angry when black people get rights. At a time when the Black Lives Matter movement is sweeping the country and hopefully bringing about sweeping change to systemic racism, our conversation with Carol Anderson is as relevant today as it was in 2017. What's notably different now is how many white people have gotten the message that black lives matter to them as well. Among a host of other recent important books on race, Anderson's White Rage may well have contributed to that raising of consciousness among whites. Here's a shortened version of our 2017 conversation about the book. This book, White Rage, first, I want to say right away that it is a powerfully written book powerful because it really delves into the history of a phenomenon that has been so ingrained in our national culture that, and yet so unseen by so many who haven't been the immediate victims of it. You know, the issue of racial strife is always framed in terms of Black rage, from the Black Power days of Stokely Carmichael to Black Lives Matter today. You say this entirely misses the point.
Entirely. Absolutely entirely. And in fact, the book emerged. It started ruminating with the killing of Amadou Diallo and listening to Rudy Giuliani, the mayor of New York, being absolutely clinical in his description of a policy that was working because crime is down in New York. And this is juxtaposed to these kinds of visual images of Black people protesting the killing of an unarmed man who is gunned down in a hail of 41 bullets by the NYPD. And so I started thinking through this, but I couldn't quite name the thing, the phenomenon. And as a scholar, I'm continuing to research and I'm continuing to write. And then August 2014 came, and Ferguson, Missouri is on fire. And all of the networks were talking about this Black rage, you know, it was like looking at this spectacle of Black rage. And I had lived in Missouri for 13 years. I saw that thing. I saw how it worked. And I found myself shaking my head. No. And I went, no, this is white rage. And then I went, oh, this is white rage. And as I said, we have been so focused in on the flames that we have missed the kindling.
Yes, exactly. That's a powerful image that you create. And the white rage, what is the trigger? What is the cause of white rage?
The trigger is African-American advancement and achievement and African-Americans' refusal to accept anything but first-class citizenship. If Black people are quiet and subjugated, it's fine. But in these key moments where you see African Americans achieving, gaining access to their citizenship rights, fighting so hard for it, there is a wave of policies that emerge that are designed to absolutely undercut that advancement. And it sounds counterintuitive. Because, you know, this is the land of opportunity, the land where if you work hard, if you achieve, if you aspire, this is the space where all is possible. But it's not. And that's what white rage zeroes in on. We as a nation, we think of racism only as throwing around the N-word and the Klan and a cross-burning. But watching the way that Supreme Court decisions in the most legalistic, clinical, seemingly logical way eviscerate the rights of African Americans, the way that policies coming out of Congress, out of school boards, do the same thing, that's where the focus of this book is.
It's on the systematic use and expression of white rage. You know, I want to start with Obama, actually, because
that's a great place to start, because this is raw right now.
Exactly. You know, you say he was the ultimate affront. And in fact, the Republican response to Obama, I mean, we know how Donald Trump is, you know, systematically undoing every single positive bit of Obama's legacy, although there are some negative parts of Obama's legacy that he's happy to keep in place.
Yeah. Can't help the breeze.
Yeah, exactly. But that the Republicans actually, there was a Republican who actually said, we're not generating enough angry white guys to stay in power.
Yes. Lindsey Graham senator out of South Carolina said that. And part of what you see is that the Republican Party brought into its fold via the Southern Strategy. That's why I love the history of it, because if we understand the history of it, we understand that Donald Trump is not some aberrant phenomenon, but he is basically the culmination of years, decades of tilling in this ground of white rage. In 68, Richard Nixon decided on the Southern Strategy, and that was to lure, to entice, to woo into the Republican Party the Southern Democrats, as well as white ethnic groups in the Northeast and in the Midwest, who were absolutely disaffected, who were operating under the fear that the gains that African Americans had made in the civil rights movement could only come at their expense. And so you saw the kinds of dog whistles that Nixon used, law and order, in order to send the signal that his government, his administration, would work to curtail all of these civil rights advances. So there is a coursing through the Southern Strategy is anti-civil rights, anti-blackness. If we understand that, then we understand that they lured this toxin into the Republican Party, and that toxin took over. This explains why it was so difficult then in a field of 16 for the Republican senators and governors who were vying for president to actually outdo someone who brought to the table no governmental experience whatsoever, who brought to the table no policy understanding whatsoever, but who did bring pure, unadulterated, unvarnished white supremacy. He played to that base in just such horrific ways, from Mexicans are rapists to, you know, black hell holes, playing on that sense of a black dystopia that's a threat to America, and America is coded white. And what he brought to the table was a type of anti-Obamaism with his birther crusade that distinguished him in terms of the virulence of his racism from the other candidates.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Carol Anderson about her groundbreaking best-selling book, White Rage. You know, you call him a white supremacist, and I would agree with you. But you pointed that white supremacy is viewed in our supposedly post-racial society, or what was thought of as post-racial when Obama got elected, as the sole definition of racism. But in fact, that's not true.
No, absolutely. One of the key linguistic tricks that happened after the civil rights movement was to define racism solely in this very narrowed band of the KKK, of cross burnings. And so when we had policies, and I'll take a key policy, for instance, that emerged out of Obama's victory, which is voter suppression. It looks clinical. They use the language of protecting democracy. They use language of protecting the integrity of the ballot box by stopping rampant voter fraud. And so that kind of language cloaks what is clearly a racist policy designed to disfranchise African Americans, Hispanics, Asians, and the poor. And at first it sounds like, yeah, right. And then the way white rage works, because that veneer of legality, of respectability, gives it cover, gives it a shield. But you pull it back and you see how the policy operates, and there's this moment where you know you are looking into the abyss. So, for instance, let's take Alabama. Alabama used the language of protecting the integrity of the ballot box from voter fraud, and then required government-issued photo ID in order to register and to vote. Then what Alabama did, because remember, government-issued photo ID, was to then constrict which types of government-issued photo ID counted. And off the table immediately was public housing ID. Now, public housing, that would be government-issued photo ID. But what Alabama wanted was to say, no, this is one of the ways to get rid of the poor, and this is one of the ways to get rid of poor Latinos and poor blacks. Then Alabama said, what we're going to do is the holy grail, really, for photo ID is a driver's license or a state-issued ID, which you get out of the Department of Motor Vehicles. Then the state shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles in what are called the Black Belt counties, those counties that went for Obama in the 2008 election, and those counties that have a sizable black population. They are also the counties that have somewhere between a 25% to a 40% poverty rate. So if you shut down the Department of Motor Vehicles, you don't have public transportation, you will not allow public housing ID. How are people supposed to go two counties, three counties over who don't drive in order to get the driver's license that they need in order to exercise their right to vote? They structure the laws, and it's the way, it's similar to the kinds of disfranchisement that happened with the poll tax that came up with the rise of Jim Crow in the 1890s, which was a clear response, again, to African Americans voting and African American citizenship coming out of the Civil War.
Yeah, and actually, I think this would be a great time to delve into the history, which you do, and you start from slavery, and you go into the history from slavery to today. But I'd like to start at Reconstruction and the counter-revolution to it. How was virtual slavery reinstituted in the South after the Civil War?
One of the first moves was by President Andrew Johnson, who came to power after Lincoln's assassination. And Andrew Johnson was a former slaveholder, and he believed that the war was all about keeping the United States united. It was not about slavery as far as he was concerned. So he provided nothing in terms of support for the newly freed. But what he did provide, though, was amnesty for the Confederate leadership. So for the people who attacked the United States and tried to destroy it, he provided amnesty, which then gave them the ability to come back into power in 1865. So, you know, it's almost like the flames of the war are still smoldering, right? The embers are still smoldering. And the folks who had started this war are now back in power in the South. And as they start instituting their new constitutions, like Louisiana said, ours has been and will always be a government for white people. Those of African descent can never be citizens. And on that basis, they began to institute the Black Codes. And the Black Codes required African Americans to sign a labor contract, an annual labor contract, that tied them to that one employer. If they refused to sign, they could be arrested for vagrancy, and then their labor auctioned off to the highest bidder.
So like slavery, in other words.
Exactly. And the Black Codes had things in there such as African Americans could basically only work in agriculture or as domestics. They could not work in any other field. So during slavery, if someone had mastered the skill, say, of being a blacksmith, that was not a skill that that person would then be able to use in the post-Civil War moment, unless a judge or a mayor signed off that that newly freed person would be able to do that. So it was to reconstitute an agricultural workforce tied to an employer, but this time with a wonderfully wicked layer of using the criminal justice system as a means to absolutely enforce African Americans continuing to work in the fields. And think about how that is so disruptive of what we understand as a capitalist economy, where you can take your labor to the employer who has the best conditions, the best wages, the best working conditions, but this absolutely short-circuits that.
Yeah, and there's a link to mass incarceration. Even though mass incarceration is seen as something that started, let's say, in the 70s or 80s,
mm-hmm.
really in the South, it began with the Black Codes.
It began with the Black Codes. The linking of blackness with criminality, particularly, I mean, it started earlier in the North, but it gripped and seized the moment after the Civil War because there had to be a way to put all of this black labor back under the subjugation of white planters, white owners, white businessmen. And it had to do so in a way that stripped African Americans of their rights, because you had this battle happening in after the Civil War between President Johnson and what were called the Radical Republicans. I mean, and I know that term sounds so, like, wild now, right? Radical Republicans. But the Radical Republicans fought for what were called the Reconstruction Amendments, the 13th Amendment, the 14th Amendment, and the 15th Amendment. The 13th ended slavery. The 14th provided citizenship for those born in the United States. And the 15th provided the right to vote. And at the time, that was for men. And so the thought was 13th, 14th, and 15th ought to do it. But then it's watching the way that the Supreme Court, in a series of decisions, systematically undercut the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments, pushed all power back onto the states that saw themselves that their role was to continue to enslave black people, and watch the federal government abdicate all responsibility for ensuring the rights of American citizens.
And in fact, they used the justification of strict constitutionalism, if I remember correctly.
Yes.
And, you know, this really struck me because the first time I heard of strict constitutionalism was in context of the current right-wing Republican members of the current Supreme Court.
Yes. Yes. And so, again, if you think about that original constitution and see how beautiful that language sounds. Well, of course, the original Constitution, and it's supposed to stir up the sense of super patriotism. But that original Constitution, for instance, said that African Americans in the South could be counted as 3/5 of a human being in terms of the number of representatives that a state could have. So it was a way to provide additional voting strength and power for the slave states in the U.S. Congress without providing the rights that African Americans were supposed to have. And you see so much of that today. The issue of that's before the court right now in terms of gerrymandering, that really is about that you've got representation based on the number of the population you have in a state. So that's how many representatives you have. But then if you carve the rules just right, you've basically created that a sizable part of that population is just 3/5 of a human being. So that you get the numbers that they bring, but they don't get the representation that they deserve.
Yeah, now it's Democrats who are 3/5 of a person in a way.
Yeah.
And you know, this is really important because this is coming up against the whole issue of gerrymandering is coming before the Supreme Court. And
yes.
I have not heard very much analysis from the media. You know, it's almost assumed that, well, they're going to consider this in all due deliberation and the sober, you know, the sober mm-hmm. judge and all that. And I'm thinking, wait a second, this court is really hanging on a thread in terms of Right. What do you think might happen if you would venture a guess?
Okay. So I've been following it closely. My hope is that the folks who are there are reading the tea leaves correctly, and that Justice Kennedy is leaning toward the side of the liberals on the court. So we all end up with a 5-4 decision. But you heard Chief Justice John Roberts, who does not like voting rights, basically saying that the social science used to demonstrate that the way that the Republicans drew the districts was absolutely rigged. He said, oh, that's gobbledygook. You heard Gorsuch, who really should not be there because that was Merrick Garland's seat. You hear Gorsuch being absolutely dismissive and saying, using that language, well, where in the Constitution does it say? And that's when I loved Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg then turning and saying, okay, so how did we get to one person, one vote? And that was a Supreme Court decision in the middle of the civil rights movement.
Wow.
Yes.
That late.
Yes. Yes.
Now, I wonder if you could put the counter-revolution against Reconstruction, the Black Codes, I mean, which were incredibly brutal, enforced with violence, not just with imprisonment. Put that into the context of the current battle over Confederate monuments. And what I mean here is, you know, on the one hand, you've got the president saying, well, these are our traditions. On the other people, you know, why are people so intent, you know, on saying, wait, we don't want these monuments up?
I look at it this way, is that when you think about what the Confederacy stood for, and so you get a lot of whitewashing. You get a lot of historical amnesia. You get a lot of shell games happening where it's like, this is just our heritage. How are you denying our heritage? You know, this is about states' rights. And I say, a heritage to do what? The state's right to do what? And it's to own human beings. This was a war fought to own human beings, to buy them, to breed them, to rape them, to murder them. And I've just got to say the one other piece that which tells you the strength of white supremacy in this nation is this was a war designed to destroy the United States. You had a group of states attack the U.S. and sought to break it in two. These are traitors. So we have, because of the power of the myth, we have put traitors in the middle of our public spaces in a place of honor.
You know, I'm Jewish, and to me, what I was thinking was like, if there were a statue honoring Hitler, you know, would people think, well, you know, that's just in honor of the German ancestry of so many of our American citizens. No, it's not.
No, exactly. Exactly. Those monuments sent the signal to blacks in those areas that this is who we honor, not you. This is who we value, not you.
Carol Anderson. I spoke with her in 2017. Go to writersvoice.net. to hear the entire hour's interview. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Do you know you can go to writersvoice.net to sign up for our podcast and weekly newsletter? Find extra content there with links, book excerpts, and extended interviews. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.